It's a very difficult task for us. We need help. We need the international community to do something to help us, to support us. Northwest Syria now, it's a disaster area. We need help.
A spokesperson for the Syrian Civil Defense Aid Group, known as the White Helmets. A pair of devastating earthquakes rocked the border region between Turkey and Syria early this morning. Thousands are dead, countless more injured. The first quake measured a magnitude of 7.8 and struck as people slept. It was one of the strongest to hit the region in nearly a century, and tremors were felt as far away as Israel and Lebanon. The second quake came hours later. Both were centered in southeast Turkey, but the road ahead will be particularly difficult for Syria, which has been devastated by the decade-long civil war there, a war that's still ongoing. Joining us now is Charles Lister. He's the director of the Syria program at the Middle East Institute, a Washington, D.C. think tank. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, set the scene for us. What are you hearing from people on the ground in the northwestern part of Syria today?
It's frankly hard to know where to start. It is an absolute catastrophe. This is a region, as you say, that has borne the brunt of 12 years of horrendously brutal conflict. For all of your listeners who may have been paying attention to the war in Ukraine for the past year, imagine living through 12 years of Ukraine, and that is the scale of war that they have witnessed, and now to be struck by really a catastrophic earthquake. This was a region where 65% of the basic infrastructure was already destroyed or heavily damaged, where the medical sector has been repeatedly hit by targeted airstrikes by the Syrian regime for the past 10 years. And now they have thousands of buildings leveled to the ground, thousands of casualties, both dead and wounded. And the only actors capable of responding are, as you mentioned, the White Helmets, which are frankly a small NGO with 2,000 volunteer staff. And the ability of the international community to get in is almost zero at this point. So it is absolutely the worst case possible nightmare scenario for all of the people living there.
Well, and I want to get to that in a minute, but first, I mean, set the scene for us in terms of this area. My understanding is this is a part of the country that is mostly controlled by rebels, not the Syrian government.
Right. So that's it. So northwestern Syria is, you know, it represents about 3 or 4% of Syrian territory, but it contains about 20% of its in-country population. About 4 to 5 million people live in this small corner of the country. And these are the people in and amongst them are about 10,000 rebel fighters. But these are people who, for the past 12 years, have been besieged, bombed, gassed, you know, faced absolutely every horrendous scenario you can imagine. But at every point, they have refused to surrender and refused to reconcile and refused to submit to the regime. So this is the last kind of bastion of opposition to the regime. And as a result of that, they are the hardest hit community. Many, if not most, of the 5 million people who live in this region have not just been displaced from their homes once. Most of them have been displaced 5 to 10 times over the past 10 years. 2 million of them live in tents. And so this is an extraordinarily vulnerable population to a natural disaster like this. They're very ill placed to be able to deal with the crisis that they now face.
And you mentioned the hospital infrastructure had been, attacked and bombed over the past decade or so. So where does that leave the ability of medical professionals to respond to a devastating event like this?
Right. So there are about 50 sort of hospitals and medical clinics scattered throughout this northwestern region. Most of them are run by coalitions of charities, many of them based in Europe and the United States, as well as some that are operated by the opposition on the ground inside the country and by civil society. So they are capable of dealing with an airstrike that may injure 10, 15, 20 people. They are completely incapable of dealing with the scale of disaster that they are facing right now. So what I'm hearing from medical personnel on the ground is that every single one of those hospitals and medical clinics is completely overwhelmed. They are treating people on the floors, on the streets outside. Dead bodies are piled up in the corridors because the morgues are completely full. People are being buried in mass graves right now to try and make space for medical treatment. Again, to come back to this is an absolute sort of nightmare situation. It is that nothing worse, frankly, could have happened to such a vulnerable area of the world.
That is just devastating. And you mentioned that international aid, it's, you said it was almost impossible. So set the scene. I mean, this is an area that's not controlled by the government. They seem unwilling to, you know, send domestic aid. So that would leave international aid that would have to respond. But Turkey, similarly, is devastated by this. So what does that mean for any foreign government's ability to send aid to Syria?
Right. So you set the scene really well there. The issue is the regime doesn't, frankly, allow assistance from inside Syria to reach this region. It's effectively sort of semi-besieged. The only international aid that gets to these 4 to 5 million people comes via the Turkish border across one border crossing. There used to be many other border crossings through which we could provide international assistance, but the Russians used their UN veto to shutter all of them over the past 3 years. So there is one crossing open through which the UN has been providing humanitarian assistance. The big problem here is that border crossing has one main road that runs to it, and that road has been crippled by the earthquake. It's basically impassable right now. And so at the moment, the concept of any form of assistance, food baskets, let alone lifting equipment to get people out of the rubble, is completely off the table. They are completely cut off in this northwestern Syrian region. So if there is going to be any kind of international attempt to get help, to get assistance, to get equipment into this region, it is going to be a very heavy lift, and it is going to take real diplomatic will to see that happen. And quite frankly, we're not seeing that diplomatically in public right now. Most of the statements from governments around the world, including the United States, have sort of insisted that we'll be providing all the assistance necessary to help Turkey, and of course, rightfully so. But then Syria is kind of an afterthought in those statements. And that is largely a reflection of the complexity. But the Syrian people in this region are so much more vulnerable. They don't have a government to look after them with anything like government type capabilities.
Well, I want to read you a statement that President Biden put out. He says, "Our teams are deploying quickly to begin to support Turkish search and rescue efforts and address the needs of those injured and displaced by the earthquake. U.S. supported humanitarian partners are also responding to the destruction in Syria." So parse that out for me. What does that mean for U.S. aid for this area?
So that is essentially saying that the small NGOs that operate in this northwestern Syrian region that we support financially, it's on them to support, you know, to essentially to undertake the rescue effort and the recovery. And as I detailed earlier, when we were talking about the White Helmets, you know, the White Helmets are the best placed local actor to respond to something like this, but they have operationally today about 1,500 volunteer personnel operating amidst a population of 4 to 5 million people. They're capable and they are frankly heroes, but they do not have anywhere near the kind of resources or the reach or the scale of equipment necessary to deal with this kind of disaster. And so it's a little bit of a kind of a cop-out, frankly, to say, well, our partners who we provided limited assistance to in the past will be continuing to respond to this disaster. A lot more than that is needed to deal with what they currently face.
Well, just really quickly, we've only got about 10 seconds. So what does this mean? Is Syria, is this region, is it going to be able to recover?
Frankly speaking, they were already in an extraordinarily bad place. This has just made it a lot worse. The UN described it as the most acute humanitarian crisis in the world. I'd say it was 10 times worse than that today.
Charles Lister, the director of the Middle East Institute's Syria program. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here. We'll look at a legal fight in Texas over a drug used in medication abortions, a decision that could have ripple effects even for states like California. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy, in for Madeline Brand. Abortion opponents celebrated last summer's Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. But now they're looking for other ways to undo both federal and state regulations around the ability to terminate a pregnancy. In Texas, a group of anti-abortion medical organizations and doctors has sued to end the FDA's decades-old approval of a drug called mifepristone. It's one of two drugs used in tandem to end an early pregnancy. A decision in the case could come as soon as this week. And if abortion opponents are successful, the ruling could upend protections even in blue states like California and New York, where the right to an abortion is enshrined in the state's constitutions. It's Monday, so Press Play's Legal Eagle is here, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Hi.
Hi, Michelle. Good to be here.
Well, it is great to have you. So give us an overview of this case. What is the group's argument that mifepristone should now be banned?
This is a suit that's filed by conservative groups in Texas, and they're seeking to undo the FDA's approval, as you said, of mifepristone. And it's really a remarkable argument here. Mifepristone was approved more than two decades ago, and what they're claiming is that the FDA failed to do its job, that they failed to rigorously test this particular drug. We should say, despite the fact that the FDA, all indications are, did go through their typical rigorous scientific testing, and there's been decades of use of mifepristone since that approval.
Has this ever happened before? A group successfully been able to challenge a decades-old FDA decision to approve a drug and get it taken off the market?
Not that I'm aware of, and not that the Department of Justice is aware of, because they wrote in response that this was unprecedented and they couldn't find any prior case where a group said, we're looking at what the FDA did and we're looking at what they did again decades ago. And we want, as an advocacy organization, to upend that process. We want to say that they did not do their job. And what the Department of Justice is arguing here is that there are really no law or facts behind that assertion.
And is there a statute of limitations here, though? I mean, again, this was approved in 2000, 23 years ago. I would think that there would be a limit to the time period in which a drug's approval can be challenged.
So that is one of the issues in the case. There's an issue of standing in the case, whether or not the people who brought the case are actually harmed enough by the approval of the drug, or if, frankly, anybody's harmed by the approval. And then there's also the statute of limitations issue. And if the court wants to basically avoid that big question of, can an advocacy group, in this case, are they right to say that the FDA should not have approved mifepristone? They could go to those procedural arguments and say, well, there's a standing issue or there's a statute of limitations issue. But if they want to get to the big question, as I suspect maybe the judge in this case does, then they can move past that.
So could the groups challenging mifepristone's FDA approval try to come after the other drug in this two-drug regimen, misoprostol? If they're successful, I guess we need to put in that caveat.
So if they are successful, then yes, I think that provides a blueprint for them going after additional drugs. Now, the other drug in the two-drug treatment where people can obtain, again, these chemically induced abortions where they account for more than half of abortions throughout the country, that's widely used throughout the world. And it's widely used throughout the world on its own. So could they go after another drug? They could, but I think they might face an even more difficult battle given the widespread use of misoprostol.
And when it comes to abortion advocates, I think the big concern is not necessarily this decision that might be coming sometime this week. It's the path that it would likely take going from there. So let's say hypothetically that this judge in Texas does rule for the plaintiffs. Where does the case go from there, assuming the Biden administration would appeal?
So if they do appeal, then it goes to the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. I believe 12 of the 16 judges on that circuit are considered to be conservative jurists. At that point, if again, there's a three-judge panel that rules against the Biden administration for these anti-abortion advocates, then the Biden administration can decide to appeal to the full Fifth Circuit or go up to the Supreme Court. And like the Supreme Court said when it announced their decision in Dobbs, basically, we've done our job here. Now we leave it to the states. And a lot of us knew not at all. The floodgates for litigation are open. And this is one aspect of that type of litigation that could move its way back up to the Supreme Court.
And we have to say again, when we're speaking hypothetically, and there's a lot of ways that various decisions could or may go. But, you know, broadly speaking, let's say this does make it all the way up to the Supreme Court and the conservative justices do side with the plaintiffs. What could that mean, more broadly speaking, for the FDA's drug approval process?
I think that's such an important question because, of course, abortion is a hugely important question, but the FDA's approval process is also something that the public relies on, pharmaceutical companies rely on. And there's something the Department of Justice is really arguing here, which is, do you want an advocacy group and or one federal judge or a number of federal judges, if this is appealed, to be able to undercut what the FDA has done, not just for this particular drug, but what it could mean more largely to the process.
Switching to another story, you mentioned the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. A panel of judges there last week struck down a federal law that bans people subject to a restraining order due to domestic violence from possessing firearms. What did the court say?
Well, what the court said here, and this is one of these fascinating cases where the court is interpreting the Supreme Court's decision in Bruin from last term, is that there's no historic reason that you could allow a federal law that bans people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders from having guns. And what they're saying here is we're looking at the Supreme Court's language in that Bruin case, and we're looking at the way they tell us to analyze Second Amendment restrictions. And we have to look just at the text and just at history. And we don't think there's any room for these restrictions under that new text.
And before we get into that new interpretation, does this law apply nationwide or is it just to the Fifth Circuit Appeals District?
Well, the law applies nationwide, but the ruling would apply at this point just to the Fifth Circuit, which includes Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas.
Okay, so this doesn't mean that anyone with a restraining order against them for domestic violence can now have a firearm without restrictions, right?
So at this point, based on the court's ruling, I think it's just a Fifth Circuit decision. There are some rulings dealing with nationwide injunctions. I don't think this is one of them.
Okay. And so you mentioned Bruin, this case the Supreme Court decided last summer. It basically created this new framework for how courts should interpret gun laws. Again, how did that decision factor into this particular case?
I think this decision just looms so large in this case. And actually, the case went up to the Fifth Circuit before. It was not particularly successful. It's a little procedurally complicated, but the punchline here is that after the Supreme Court's decision in Bruin, the Fifth Circuit took another look. They looked at this challenge and they said, okay, well, we have a new standard to apply. And they said, it's not okay under that standard. We're just looking at the text. We're just looking at history, and history would not allow this type of restriction.
How likely is this case to make it up to the Supreme Court?
I think that really depends on whether or not the Supreme Court wants to keep taking big Second Amendment challenges. So if this ultimately is appealed up to the Supreme Court, it really is, again, a question of whether or not there are four justices who say, we want to make sure to remake Second Amendment law very quickly. And I think there are four votes to do that.
Jessica Levinson, our regular legal eagle here at Press Play. She teaches law at Loyola Law School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a growing fight over 10,000-year-old water sitting underneath the Mojave Desert.
This water has been accumulating for thousands of years, and the consequences are going to echo for thousands of years. You know, we're not just going to see like a pit in the earth open up.
The ethical debate over prehistoric water amid our historic drought. That's next on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Deep below the Mojave Desert is liquid gold. Trillions of gallons of water in an underground aquifer stretching hundreds of square miles on either side of Interstate 40. It's been there for thousands of years, but only a tiny bit of it is actually tapped and harvested. So it could be a way to ease some of California's water woes. Private companies are trying to do just that, but they're running into obstacles from conservationists who question the ethics of it, and native tribes who have a spiritual connection to the water in this region. Brett Simpson wrote about the fight over California's ancient underground water for The Atlantic, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being here. So set the scene for us and describe what it is, what it's like out there. Where is this aquifer?
Yeah, so you drive out east from Los Angeles for hours, just straight into the Mojave Desert. And as you kind of reach the unincorporated Route 66, there's a fork in the road where if you turn left, you'll hit the ghost town of Baghdad, California, which still holds America's record for having the driest spell in recorded history. A century ago, it went more than 2 years without rain. And then if you turn right and drive for just a few more miles on this cracked highway, round piles of sand, you'll see the most unlikely mirage, just hundreds of acres of citrus groves. And that is Cadiz Farms, which has tapped this massive ancient aquifer to feed a modest operation. But Cadiz Inc. has much bigger plans for this water than this citrus grove.
And so you can't see, I guess, the aquifer. It's down below ground. But when did it get so full? How did the water get there? Tell us a little bit about the history of this aquifer. It's called the Fenner Aquifer, right?
Yeah, the Fenner Aquifer. Yeah, and it's a few hundred feet below ground, but it took a long time to get there. So 10,000 years ago, during the last ice age, the Mojave climate was much wetter. And during that time, when a lot of water was falling, some of it seeped down into the soil. And it just kept seeping deeper and deeper. And yeah, it's just fresh groundwater. I saw it myself coming out of sprinklers and hoses at Cadiz Farms. But it's as much as 34 million acre feet, which is about enough to fill 17 million Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Wow. And I imagine, as you said, this is not water that's necessarily renewable.
Right. So the catch is it is a non-renewable resource on a human timescale. So when we take it out, no proxy for our own civilization will ever see it replenish.
So environmentally, what are the consequences of tapping into this aquifer? I mean, there's no question California, surrounding states need the water. And if you have 17 million Olympic-sized swimming pools just kind of sitting there, I mean, what are the consequences of tapping it?
Well, the answer to that is complicated because we don't really know. But when talking to hydrogeologists, the big problem that comes up is that you can predict and you can model the impacts, you know, subsidence, effects on species. But really, this water has been accumulating for thousands of years, and the consequences are going to echo for thousands of years. So it's really hard. You know, we're not just going to see like a pit in the earth open up. And I think that it's really hard to talk about these environmental consequences.
So tell me a little bit more about this company, Cadiz. They're kind of leading the charge to tap this aquifer. Who are they and what is their big plan?
So actually, this company in its various iterations has been around for a few decades now. In the early 80s, this British entrepreneur teamed up with a geologist and bought this property likely for the water. They dug a few wells and set up an agricultural operation and then just sort of started planning this water project and shopping it around to different Los Angeles water districts like, hey, this water is here. We can run a pipeline in various directions. And right now, I think it's important to emphasize, one, they have planned for two pipelines. One is going to connect straight to the Colorado River, and then they will sell this water, you know, down the road. Other water districts will get a little bit of extra Colorado River water. And this company, Cadiz, very much emphasizes they are, in fact, a water storage company. So they're saying they're kind of creating space in the aquifer. They're selling this water. And somewhere down the line, there will be surplus or, you know, flood water from the Colorado River that then we can stick back underground and keep it safe from evaporation.
Yeah, so break that down for us, because the storage aspect is a little bit of a head scratcher, right? Because so they're saying that we're going to tap this water that's 10,000 years old. We're going to pull it out of the ground. People are going to be able to use it as drinking water, as farming water. And then they're saying, but the other benefit is that we're going to be able to store water underground. How are they envisioning this working? Because the whole reason that we are even, I guess, considering tapping this water is because we are running out of it and we need more. And it's so, yeah, it's a little bit confusing. What water is it that they are hoping to store?
Right. So I think that they would argue, you know, with more extreme weather events, we often get, you know, a sudden influx of water and flooding, and there might be an opportunity to channel some of that water into storage. But many experts and critics that I've talked to will say, you know, okay, first of all, groundwater storage is and will continue to be extremely important in California's water conservation strategy, because putting water underground is evaporation safe. So it's like putting money in the bank. And they actually call these groundwater banks. But first of all, the state of California has a lot of empty space under it already. The San Joaquin Valley, case in point, the Central Valley is sinking, and we actually really need to refill our aquifers there.
Right. It's sinking because we've overdrawn the aquifers there.
Exactly. And it's actually a great way to kind of bring them back to health is to store water, you know, recharge these aquifers with whatever, you know, surplus water we may have. The center of the state really needs it. And so that I think that this kind of the idea that we need to create space in one of California's only nearly untouched supplies to then store water, it's, I think, you know, it is a bit of a head scratcher. And then too, you know, as you said, this is much more to the point that they assume, you know, their same customers who are buying this water somewhere down the line, you know, the water cycles of flood or plenty, and that's just how it is with water. So somewhere down the line, there will be a water surplus here, and the Colorado River will have this surplus. But as we're seeing, the idea that the Colorado River will ever have surplus again, I think is really something to question and perhaps not bank on in the future.
Right. I mean, the state and six others are facing cuts potentially that would have to be imposed by the federal government because it has been drawn down so extensively. So what does Cadiz say? I mean, what's their argument for why this is, you know, vitally necessary right now?
Well, one, I think it's a big infrastructure project. And, you know, it's creating pipelines. One is going to the Colorado River, but the other pipeline, the Northern Pipeline, will go through many of these Central Valley communities that are cut off from water. And so I think that right now they're really talking about making a strong case for California's water infrastructure is broken. We are an infrastructure project. We can bring water, you know, not just to wealthy Southern California neighborhoods, but to other folks who need it. And yeah, I think that that goes back to this question, this very essential ethical question is, should we take this water out? Should we take it out now? And who's it going to?
Well, and what's, I guess, stopping them from doing that? I mean, before we, because I want to get into the ethical part of this, but what's stopping Cadiz right now from jumping feet first into this?
Right, yeah. So there are several, it's been through several cycles of legal battles, and as the political winds have shifted, different approvals, different rejections. You know, Obama's Department of the Interior rejected a crucial right-of-way along a railroad line for one of the pipelines, and then Trump's BLM then reversed that. And now, you know, it then went back to a judge, and Biden went in the other direction, and so the judge under Biden. So I think it really is, there is a political back and forth. And yeah, these legal battles from conservationists and also the Chemehuevi tribe, which for them, Bonanza Springs, if it is connected, it is protected under the Mojave Trails National Monument, and it is a sacred stopping point in their Salt Songs Trail ritual, which is an ancient ceremonial loop through the desert of 142 songs that they sing at these sacred stopping points along the way. And it's a kind of spiritual and physical description of a landscape is embedded in these songs.
So that does get us to the ethical quandaries here. Can you describe that conflict and this idea? I guess I don't want to say it's a growing movement. You write about how it's been around for a really long time, but this idea that we can kind of no longer be divorced from thinking about where our water is coming from, that we can't just turn on our taps and expect it to be there anymore.
Absolutely. Ethics and water have been intertwined since time immemorial. We can assume, you know, as long as we've been relating with each other, we have been sharing water or competing for water. And I think that that biological imperative, the fact that we need it to survive, really differentiates this from other non-renewable resources that we might talk about that may lay under a desert. And it also makes it even more, as these ethicists would argue, and then of course the tribal leaders as well, that for the past century or so, water rights decisions have had this emphasis on technical and economical questions. And, you know, of course, legal, but those are ethical to the point of property ownership, i.e. I own land downstream, you can't take it all before it reaches me. But the fact is that nobody has this purely economical relationship with water. We need it to survive. And in this age of scarcity, of transboundary conflict around water, they're arguing we need to put ethics in the forefront of these decisions. And we need to at least acknowledge that this is a part of the conversation, because right now there's nothing explicit in California law that protects ancient non-renewable water from being sold to the highest bidder.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You know, ethics are subjective. So how do you use subjective considerations to set policy that will ultimately affect everyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is exactly kind of the set of questions that do kind of make us tend toward the economical or the technical challenges, because those might be a little bit easier to solve. But when we take these questions out of the conversation, you end up with really, really bizarre policy in the end. So I think that actually these water ethicists would be very uncomfortable with being too prescriptive or giving you a set of, you know, do's and don'ts. It may be that the best thing is to take this water out. They're just saying, ask the questions first. You know, if this resource has been here for 10,000 years, should we take it or should we leave it for future generations? Will they need it more? What are our alternatives right now? Is it going first to the people who need it most? So I think that it's opening up a set of questions that, yes, it might be tough to create policy around this, but right now it might not, it also might not be at the forefront of our policy conversations.
So what's going to happen? How do you see this ending?
Yeah, well, I've heard a joke that this project's popularity tends to cycle with droughts. So the way it's looking now in our mega drought, it could be that it starts to make a lot of sense to a lot more people. We don't know. If you ask Cadiz, they're well on their way. And, you know, these legal battles continue. At this point, time will tell. So far, time has been on this water's side, but we'll have to see.
Brett Simpson, you can read her big piece about the fight over California's ancient water in the Atlantic. Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on this show, you can make a record out of, well, a lot of things. And during the Cold War, people in the Soviet Union did just that, using old X-rays. The story of bone music, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely.
That is, of course, Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis Presley. It was his first number one hit and helped kick off a radical transformation in pop music and pop culture in the decade after World War II. But while much of the world clamored for more of the rock, jazz, and blues music that was exploding in the West, the communist Soviet Union officially banned those genres and tons of other music. That doesn't mean Soviet citizens weren't listening to Elvis, though.
The
Now, that crackling, warbling version of Elvis's hit song is actually a bootleg version, recorded onto a thin sheet of X-ray film. That's right, X-ray. Picture a black and white, translucent image of a rib cage or a skull, cut into a circle and inscribed with the forbidden sounds of rock and roll. These records were secretly sold in dark alleys throughout the Soviet Union. This history is detailed in the new book, Bone Music. Stephen Coates is the author, and he joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, Michelle. It's so good to hear that still, isn't it? So it still rocks, you know, after all these years, it still rocks.
Yeah, it does. It really hits you in the heart. I mean, not to sound cliche, but there's no way around it.
Absolutely no way around it, yeah.
So how did you come across this in the first place? I mean, this was all underground during the Soviet Union. So how did you first learn about this?
Right. So, Michelle, I've been traveling to perform in Russia for many years with my band, The Real Tuesday World. And we've been playing there off and on for about 15 years, I guess. And my habit when we performed there was the day after the gig was to go to a flea market. I never had a hangover because I don't drink. The rest of my band will be, you know, in a terrible state after the gig. So I'd go out shopping early in the morning. And I was in a flea market in St. Petersburg. And I collect records, but I particularly collect strange records. And on one particular stall, I saw a very strange record. And I asked my Russian friends about it. They didn't know what it was. But of course, you know, as you just alluded to in that intro, when I held it up to the light, you could see two skeletal hands. It was a record that had been made onto an X-ray. And I think I knew in that moment, it was like being hit by some sort of epiphany. I had to find out who made it, why they made it, and how they made it. And really, it was those three questions that sort of propelled me over the next 7 or 8 years to discover this Bone Music story.
Well, I gotta ask you, I mean, I know we all know what a record looks like, but how did you know that this was a record? It's on X-ray film. I mean, it was cut out in a circle, but how did you look at it and instinctually know, like, yes, this is a record, I have to go home and play it?
Yeah, I mean, I could tell it was some sort of flexi disc. I knew that. But beyond that, it wasn't really until you held it up to the light that you could see that it was an X-ray. But I could tell it was a record, yeah.
And so, like we heard in the intro, the sound quality on these records is not optimal. How did they even realize, though, that they could take X-ray paper and turn it into a record?
Right. So the big difference between how conventional records, you know, black vinyl records are made in these things is that black vinyl records, you know, they're made by a pressing process in factories. You know, they stamp these master discs into soft black plastic and make tens of thousands of this stuff, right? Well, these records aren't made like that. They're made on machines which are called recording lathes. They look something like a record player. They're big, chunky things. And they work in reverse, like a record player in reverse. So instead of dropping a needle on which reads the groove of a disc, you feed an audio signal into the arm and it cuts a groove onto the surface of a blank disc. Now, it just so happens that X-ray film is strong enough to take the groove and to hold it and play it back. But the really important thing is that in the Soviet Union at this time, they used X-ray film because they had no access to commercial materials, and you could get hold of these things because everybody in the Soviet Union, probably like everybody in America at the time, had been x-rayed to see if they had tuberculosis. So there were an awful lot of x-rays hanging around the hospitals, and for a few, you know, for a few rubles for a bottle of vodka, a deal could be made at night, and the bootleggers would get themselves a stack of blank media, as we would say.
So they all had to be individually made. What was the life expectancy of one of these things? I mean, how many turns could you get out of it before it kind of wore through?
Yeah, so this era really started around about 1946. And at that time, people were still using gramophones, you know, wind-up gramophones. Well, if you drop a steel needle of a wind-up gramophone onto one of these records, you probably get about 10 plays out of it maximum, right? It will deteriorate in front of your eyes. But when electric record players came in, maybe 30, 40, but they were ephemeral. These were things which you bought on the street. They were street trash in a way. You played them for the music that was on them and you wore them out. And then, generally speaking, you would throw them away and try and get another one.
So the Soviet government saw all things Western, especially Western culture, as this existential threat to communist rule, the kind of soft power that can win over hearts and minds. So how did people who were living in the Soviet Union at the time even get access to this music in the first place?
Right. Well, there were several ways, but I just want to add one part of the body onto your hearts and minds, which is also the groin, because actually the as we heard there with Elvis at the beginning, this music was sexy, right? And rock and roll is sexy. And a big fear, actually, was that it would in some way pollute young people's minds and it, by causing the wrong kind of feelings, should we say, right? So there's a kind of moral dimension to it as well as an ideological one. So in answer to your question, how did they get it? Well, first of all, we, the Brits, you, the Americans, were actively broadcasting jazz and rock and roll into the Soviet Union. And even though they tried to jam it to stop it, sometimes it got through, particularly in places like Leningrad, St. Petersburg, as we call it. And a place like Leningrad, which I guess it's a bit like Liverpool, maybe like LA, it's a port. It's also the place that sailors would set off for to travel to other lands and come back. They could bring records back and smuggle them in. And of course, the children of high-level apparatchiks, diplomats, the privileged few, had access to American goods and music and magazines and clothes too. So they could get it and they could lend or rent out their record collection to eager bootleggers. So there are various ways to do it, yeah.
Well, let's take a listen to some more of the music that you've uncovered. This is a recording by the jazz artist Ella Fitzgerald.
Have you ever heard two turtle doves, Bill and Sue, when they love? That's the kind of magic music we make with our lips when we kiss. And as the wind blows,
Soviet authorities seemed particularly obsessed with jazz, I guess, and not even just Western jazz, but jazz artists in the Soviet Union. You wrote about a Polish trumpeter named Eddie Rosner, who was considered kind of the Soviet Louis Armstrong at the time, and he was even sent to a Siberian prison camp. So what was it about jazz in particular that the Soviets deemed so unacceptable?
Well, I've got a theory about jazz, which is that there's something about it which is just completely inimical to the tyrannical mind. Dictators of all hues, you know, think about Hitler, Stalin, you know, the guy in North Korea at the moment, you know that they hate jazz. You know that they don't listen to John Coltrane or Ella Fitzgerald. You can tell. There's something about it which they find threatening. I think it's obviously the swing, but particularly the idea of improvisation, you know, the idea of soloists. In a country like the Soviet Union, the emphasis on music was massed choirs, you know, people singing together, working together for this great ideal of the future. So there was always something threatening about jazz. Now, jazz was in the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s. But Michelle, there's one thing I really got to say about this whole story, which is very important. It wasn't just jazz and it wasn't just rock and roll. It wasn't just Western music. They were forbidding their own music. Huge amounts of Russian music was forbidden for various reasons. And in some ways, this is the real tragedy of the story, because it was the Cold War. We didn't like their stuff, right? They didn't like our stuff. But they were a culture that was becoming cut off from itself. You know, dearly loved, beloved songs of the Russian people, they were no longer allowed to listen to.
So in the wake of this repression, this black market for this music springs up. Talk a little bit about how that worked, how people could still go buy this bone music secretly, covertly.
You really had to buy it on the street. This was street culture. I guess if you imagine the soft drug trade, right, in, you know, buying cannabis or something in the UK now, and in some countries in the world, it was like that. It was a street culture. So maybe you knew somebody. Maybe you could go to somebody's apartment who was making or dealing these records. But if you didn't, you'd have to go and seek dealers out on the street. And they would be hiding out in alleyways, in flea markets, in dark corners. You know, you might ask for something like jazz, rock and roll. You might ask for Little Richard even, you know, a specific artist. And then they would take out from under their shirt this wad of flexible records and they would sell you one. And you would go home, scurry home, hoping that you'd actually got what you asked for.
Well, I was going to say, that brings me to my next piece of music that I want to play. This is another disc you found. It was labeled Cheek to Cheek by Fred Astaire. But when you played it, here's what you got. Okay, so it's pretty obvious there. That is not cheek to cheek. How common was this? And frankly, how did people even know they were getting the right thing sometimes if this was music that was banned?
They didn't, actually. That's the thing about it. That smoke gets in your eyes, right? So, now, in that case, I think the person, you know, got off quite lightly, really, because, okay, they didn't get cheek to cheek, but they got a similar tune, and it's quite a nice tune, right? But sometimes people would come back and complain later that they'd, you know, they'd expected to get a rock and roll tune, but then they'd passed off some sort of classical waltz on them, you know? So it was a risky business in the sense that you were risking it at the under the watchful eye of the authorities, but also never really knowing what you got. Now, that did work out sometimes for the best. One person I interviewed, very old, he's dead now, but a very old man, of course, that's the first way he heard the Beatles was that he thought he was playing a Little Richard record, but when he got home, it was the Beatles, and when he played it, and it changed his life. So it could cut both ways, but it was a very uncertain business.
So we talked a little bit about the brutal crackdown that the Soviet leaders would resort to keep this music in check. What happened to people who were caught with this bone music?
Well, in the 1940s and early 1950s, you know, while Stalin was still alive, it was extremely dangerous to make and deal these records. So you would go to prison. You'd go to a Soviet prison, which is, as you can imagine, is a pretty brutal place. Ruslan Bogoslovsky, he was one of the better known bootleggers from Leningrad, served 3 prison terms. I interviewed Rudolf Fuchs, who was in prison for 3 years himself for making these records. So the highest punishment probably would be for being caught making them. The second level of punishment would be for caught dealing them. If you were a kid who bought the records, you probably wouldn't face prison, but you would face a dressing down, a public shaming, possibly. It might affect your kind of career or education prospects. And, you know, maybe if you're a repeat offender, you would be in more serious trouble. So it was that kind of thing, you know, particularly in the 40s and 50s, yeah.
There's an interesting parallel now with the recent Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has outlawed any media that talks about the invasion of Ukraine. So how do you understand the current environment, what we're seeing now, in the context of the research that you have done on Soviet history and censoring music?
Well, I've got a lot of Russian friends, so it's a very painful situation all the way around. You know, many of them are now in exile. But the speed at which it's kind of seems to have unraveled in terms of cultural repression back to the Soviet era has been deeply shocking, you know. And as you say, lots of media is being forbidden. Words are being forbidden. You know, you can get put in prison for using the word war, right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, cultural censorship on a drastic scale with, you know, playwrights being in prison, filmmakers. Music is, I think with music, largely speaking, the horse has bolted because of the internet. And also, I think in some ways, music has lost its power in terms of ideological use. You could say that, right? So I think they concentrate on other things. Now, they don't bother trying to stop young people listening to music. But if you were a Russian rapper and you are a singer-songwriter who was voicing protest against the war, you'd be in deep trouble. You'd be arrested for sure. Absolutely. So, you know, the rappers that are doing that are living outside Russia now. There is a message, I think, in the story of bone music, which is positive, which is even though these X-ray records only contributed slightly, possibly, to the perestroika and glasnost and the end of the Soviet Union, they were a little bit like a seed which grew into a plant, which grew into a tree. And, you know, that tree itself became part of a forest of protest, you know, which did make a difference. And I think the story itself is testament to the indomitability of the human spirit, particularly when it comes to culture. We will see it through in some way. And so I think that's a hopeful message in these strange, dusty records, that change can come about, even if it seems impossible.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This was such a great conversation.
It's a pleasure to be back with KCRW. It's been a long time.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back. That's Stephen Coates. His new book is called Bone Music. And that does it for us today on Press Play. I'm Michelle Lalloy. I'll see you tomorrow.